Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. It's days like these that back up the Merriam-Webster Dictionary's choice for word of the year of 2016, the word surreal. In a span of merely 15 hours, we heard President Obama bid farewell like this.
It falls to each of us to be those anxious, jealous guardians of our democracy. To embrace the joyous task we've been given, to continually try to improve this great nation of ours. Because for all our outward differences, we in fact all share the same proud title, the most important office in a democracy, citizen.
And then we heard President-elect Trump greet viewers of his first news conference since being elected like this.
It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen. And it was gotten by opponents of ours, as you know, because you reported it and so did many of the other people. It was a group of opponents that got together, sick people, and they put that crap together.
I can't improve on Merriam-Webster's choice, so I'll just join them. Surreal. And boy, are we lucky right now, because by sheer coincidence of the timing of a book publication date, we have with us in the studio both Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne and MSNBC's Joy Ann Reid, who hosts the show AM Joy on Saturday and Sunday mornings. Together, they have edited a collection of Barack Obama speeches under the title We Are the Change We Seek, The Speeches of Barack Obama. We'll talk about communication styles and how they relate to styles of presiding over a democracy, and also about other news of the day, including some of the confirmation hearings we've been listening to. Hi, EJ. Hi, Joy. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back here. Great to be on the show.
Yeah. And obviously, you're both liberal or progressive commentators, so with that as disclosure and context, what were you thinking yesterday as you saw these contrasting events unfold almost back-to-back? EJ, your column this morning is about this.
I have to confess I found the Trump news conference petrifying. I found it petrifying for his tone in particular toward adversaries and the press. A president who's about to take office, you might think he'd be in a celebratory mood, and instead he turns to attacking Hillary Clinton again. His refusal to let Jim Acosta of CNN ask a question. I think the media are going to have to learn the meaning of the word solidarity, because I don't think that a president should be given license to do what he did. We're a republic, not a monarchy. But in the larger sense, one of the things that struck me trying to think about our book and Obama and Trump is that rhetorically, Obama is a we guy, an our guy. You heard that in the clip from the farewell address. Mm-hmm. Trump is a resolutely I guy. You can argue that the most famous Trump line so far that he tried to give in a memorable speech was at the Republican convention, I alone can fix it.
Wait, I was thinking about the same thing.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
So when Obama, Joy, talks about the most important role is citizen, when he ends his farewell address with that long colloquy about how people need to go out and do things between elections and protect the democracy and organize and participate, and Trump comes along and says, I alone can fix it, the words stand in such stark contrast.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if irony wasn't already dead, and it is officially dead as of 2016, I would say that it's deeply ironic that you have Barack Obama, the public school kid who grew up struggling with, you know, as exotic as his background and his mother's sort of adventures were, he did grow up sort of a struggling public school kid with an African father, is the guy who is the biggest believer in the fundamental American experiment that you could possibly have. Right? He really believes that the founding creed, even as imperfect as the founders were, is something that we can all embrace, that we all own, and that Citizen really is the most important person. For all the talk of his sort of being too grand when he ran for president, he always ran saying, I'm just the organizer, I'm just the convener. He would say it to journalists, I'm the convener, I want the citizens to actually make the change.
Hence the title of your book, by the way, right? The collection of Obama's speeches, you called it. Is this a quote from him?
It's a quote.
Yes. We are the change we seek.
And it's a common civil rights refrain, right? We are the change we seek. Whereas Donald Trump, who's the actual Manor-born guy, he's the wealthy private school educated guy, but he's much more like, and I say this without meaning it to be pejorative, he's much more like a sub-Saharan African sort of autocrat. You know, I have friends from Iran who are saying he's much more like somebody who would govern Iran. He's much more like Hosni Mubarak when he governed Egypt than he is like an American president, in the sense that he doesn't think the citizen is the central figure. He's the central figure.
But does Trump, in a way, let me jump in on this. Does Trump, in his own way, inspire people to be active, even if it's active in ways you might not like the tens of thousands of people flock to his rallies? And I can tell you, followers of his are active in calling the show to make his case in ways that George W. Bush as president or Romney or McCain as candidates just never inspired many people in the New York area to do.
I think that there can be no doubt that Trump won those states that were critical by narrow margins because he mobilized some new voters, Republican voters, who didn't go out to vote for Mitt Romney. I think that was critical in flipping the three critical states. So there's no question. But Joy and I have talked about this, and you know, the Obama mobilized around the word hope. Trump mobilizes around rage and anger and dissatisfaction. And, you know, it's true. There are, we'll probably hear from them today on the show. There are definitely committed Trump people out there whom he has pulled in. One other point, though, I want to still stick with irony, because I refuse to believe irony is dead, no matter what anybody
says.
You're going
to resurrect it.
I love irony. Is that Trump is the person who fundamentally and on principle looks backward and says that America's best days were back there, and I'm going to make America great again. Again is key. Obama is the resolutely forward-looking guy. He had a line in the farewell address about, you know, the future and change being the constant that the younger generation believes in. But he is rooted in history. His speeches are a series of history lessons. We quote my friend Jim Kloppenberg, who wrote a great book some years ago called Reading Obama, where he studied Obama's speeches. And Jim talks about how Obama draws on sort of disparate strands of American historical lessons and brings them together. So that is another irony. The forward-looking guy likes to look back. The backward-looking guy does not much like to look back to history.
And Obama also is a guy who, in his speeches, one of the consistent themes is he's constantly admonishing his own supporters to see incremental victory as victory and to take each small step forward as a step in the grand arc toward justice that he believes history bends toward. And he says that phrase, you know, the arc of history bends toward justice a lot. And, you know, another thing upon which AJ and I agree, and by the way, we agree on everything, is that Lincoln
is boring.
Right. Yeah. Lincoln is his touchstone. That is, I think, the president that he most admires and identifies with. And this notion that even in the moment for Lincoln, when slavery is here and it's happening now, that he can see the long arc in which it cannot survive, and that even if we incrementally get there, even if Lincoln himself couldn't get there on race, right, that he couldn't get to a love for black people, he could understand that this is where history is going. LBJ had that talent. He didn't have the rhetorical skill, but he could see, no, history is going that way. We need to go that. Barack Obama is constantly telling, even after Trump wins, he says in his farewell address, no, don't look at this as failure. Look at this as the small, slow, steady march toward progress.
I want to get back to what you were saying about people from Iran and people from Egypt saying Trump reminds them of Mubarak or reminds them of somebody who could govern Iran. Are there implications for democracy when we compare speaking styles? I think this is so important because the concerns about Trump are historically abnormal precisely because it's not just about debating his policy ideas. It's about wondering if he's going to try to impose an authoritarian strongman style of government over our Constitution. So are these rhetorical style differences ominous to you in that way, or would it be an overreach to suggest that?
No, they are. I mean, I think that, I was deeply disturbed as well by the press conference. It had all of the hallmarks of authoritarian government. It had the clack of people at the side jeering and cheering the press while they're trying to do their jobs, looking over their notes. Are you going to print that in the paper tomorrow? It had that. It had the start with Sean Spicer, the spokesman, getting up and just berating the press, almost screaming at the press, followed by Mike Pence giving this encomium to the great leader. It has every hallmark. You know, this could have been my father's country, you know, and the people who've governed the Congo. And people from the region, when I talk to them, say, this is very familiar, including the kleptocratic impulses of saying, I can make money doing this job, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no rule that constrains me. There is no moral constraint on me. I do what I want because I alone am the leader. I won, and I'm going
to
do this.
And that's what made Obama's farewell address so interesting, because to me, the meat of that speech was his warning that democracy can go away if we're fearful. We can lose our democracy, that the Constitution is great, but it's not self-enforcing. You need people to stand up for democracy. And so in my column this morning in the Post, I said that precisely what Obama was warning against was, I fear, reflected in that news conference that that Trump had. I mean, I desperately hope that both Joy and I are wrong about this. I know we'd both like to be wrong about this, but I am genuinely worried about it.
Listeners, our phones are open for anything you'd like to say or ask E.J. Dionne or Joanne Reed about Obama's body of speeches, comparing Obama's and Trump's communication styles, or anything from the surreal news of this week, the confirmation hearings, or anything else. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Their book, a collection of Obama speech texts, is called We Are the Change We Seek. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne, who you can also hear every Friday as a commentator on All Things Considered, and Joy Reid, MSNBC host, whose show airs Saturday and Sunday mornings from 10 a.m. to noon, a great slot for public affairs in broadcasting. 10 a.m. to noon, A.M. Joy on MSNBC. And together, they have edited and wrote a little about Obama speech texts in the book that they've just released called We Are the Change We Seek. Our lines are full. We'll get to some callers in a few minutes. The earliest speech you reprint was from 2002, when Obama was a state senator in Illinois, not yet a national figure by any means, when he weighed in against the possibility of starting a war with Iraq. Here's 14 seconds of that.
I don't oppose war in all circumstances, and when I look out over this crowd today, I know there is no shortage of patriots or patriotism. What I do oppose is a dumb war.
So people sometimes say, EJ, that that speech with those 14 seconds, I think the only surviving audio, was as big a reason as any that Obama was elected president 6 years later. Do you think, and was it just his opposition in contrast to Hillary Clinton's and John McCain's on the issue, or something about that speech?
Well, both. I think we had a lot of fun putting this book together, kind of trying to figure out where do you start and what do you put in it. And it seemed to both of us, I think, that in a way that speech was the beginning of Barack Obama's presidential career, even though nobody, including Barack Obama, knew that at the time. David Axelrod, in his memoir, Obama's top political advisor, says he always regrets he didn't send a TV crew to get that speech on the record. And I do think that politically, when you look back at 2008, the fact that Barack Obama had publicly on the record opposed a war that became so deeply unpopular, particularly in the Democratic Party, was critical, especially to his victory in Iowa, which in turn was critical to his, over the long run, beating Hillary Clinton. So I don't think there's any question that that speech was very important to his political trajectory.
And if we want, and since we're reviving irony, we're trying to raise it from the dead, it's ironic that one of the reasons that Donald Trump was so successful in the Republican primary is that he, too, claimed to have been four square against the Iraq War. Part of what Trump's rise was a repudiation against Bushism and what was seen as the weakness and failure and big government, sort of what people consider to be big government Republican liberalism of George W. Bush, even though, of course, Trump was for the war in the beginning. He vehemently denies that because he understands that that's part of his appeal to his base.
Khadijah in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Good morning to your guests. I wanted just to, as I said to your screen, I wanted just to give this comment. While before the elections, I was just observing everything happening, and one day I was listening to NPR, and one of the analysts said, no, America will never elect a dictator. And I'm from Africa. I grew up in Africa. I grew up listening to news, reading French newspapers describing dictatures in Africa and everywhere else in the world. And I was just, when the NPR analyst said America will never elect a dictator, I was just sadly smiling in my, not smiling, but thinking the opposite in my head, in my kitchen. I was just like, no, something is going to happen and it's going to be not really nice. And unfortunately, what happened yesterday at the news conference was a total description of what a dictator, a bully is. And it's very sad that we are talking about this in 2017. And I really am so sad. I don't know what to tell to my kids.
Can I ask what country you grew up in?
I was in Morocco. So Brian, I read my family is in the military, and we had all the newspapers and all the French magazines describing dictators and the news, of course, and RFI, Radio France Internationale, etc., etc. So it is a sad point in time for America, and I hope I'm wrong, like your guests, but we are more and more thinking the same way, unfortunately.
Can I ask you one other question? I'm just curious,
sir.
Since you mentioned the news that you were consuming about dictators growing up in Morocco,
did
you get news from the BBC at all in those days?
Yes, from the BBC and also from the Voice of America. The thing is, and we used to listen to this with my dear, may he rest in peace, dear father, and on AM, on shortwave, actually. And Voice of America and BBC and Radio France Internationale and France Culture. So,
Khadijah, thank you so much. Please call us again.
Welcome, Brian.
Bye-bye. I asked her that last question, Joy, because Trump took a shot yesterday not only at CNN and BuzzFeed, who had reported that dossier story, but at the BBC. Did you notice that?
He did. And the BBC has been reporting on the larger trend that Trump is a part of this right-wing nationalist populism that is based on anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Islamic sentiment, opposition to the migration of Syrian refugees. We're just an extension of that same trend. And the BBC has also been really ferociously following following up on the story of this dossier, the sort of scandalous dossier that I won't describe that's all over Twitter. They're not dropping that story. He's trying to bully the press, Trump is, and Sean Spicer and his team are trying to bully the press out of pursuing the story. The BBC has got, I think as of last night, they posted more information. So the international press is not going to drop this because this is not an American story. This is an international story. Trump's election is part of an international, very troubling trend.
Well, since you raised it, how legitimate a story do you think that dossier is? It is unverified information, and I believe both of your news organizations, Washington Post and NBC News, had that story for a period of time and had decided not to run with it. So did they make a different journalistic judgment than CNN or BuzzFeed at your news organizations? Or Joy, what would you say about that?
I wouldn't say we didn't. I mean, we've been talking about the possibility or probability that Donald Trump, that the Russians had some information on him since last summer. Malcolm Nance, who's an analyst that MSNBC uses, I have him on my show a lot, said on my show on July 27th, I think it was, that the belief among the intelligence community is that the Russians have some compromising information, whether it's personal or financial. David Korn at Mother Jones has been doing that story. I think he did it in September. This is open secrets that people in the intelligence community, and EJ, you can tell me if I'm wrong, have been telling journalists since last summer. So this is not scandalous. It's the only, I mean, not new. The only difference is the detail, and no one can verify it because unless we see the tape, we can't verify that what was said to be on that tape is really there.
But EJ, is that news if it's not verified? Just people speculating that the Russians might have compromising information on Trump?
Well, first of all, I want to just underscore what Joy just said. I started hearing this stuff last summer as well. This was floating around D.C. Pretty broadly, I think. Secondly, I should make very clear, I am on the opinion editorial side of the Washington Post, and I cannot, do not ever speak for the news side. And we have a very clear church-state demarcation at our paper. A lot of people don't believe that about newspapers, but it's really true.
Are you church or state?
I guess we're church. Yeah.
But,
no, your background.
So anyway, I want to make that very clear. So I speak only for myself on this. I got to say I'm torn. First of all, you got to distinguish between the CNN story and the BuzzFeed story.
Yes.
And I don't say that to knock BuzzFeed. I just say the CNN story was very sort of circumscribed. They said, and it looks like the CIA has just confirmed that, that Trump was told that there are reports of the Russians having this. And so CNN, you know, Trump is going to try to take every story, lump it together, find one flaw in one piece of one story, and then try to deny the whole thing. And we're going to have to fight against that. On the BuzzFeed thing, I have to say I have a real ambivalence. You know, I know that a lot of good news organizations, including my own, said we can't publish these things because they are unverified. And I take that very seriously as a journalistic notion. On the other hand, there are an awful lot of things that have been published in the past unverified where the document itself has some interest. So I actually understand why Ben Smith over at BuzzFeed made this decision. And I really try hard in my own head to say, what if this were done to a politician I really like and respect? And would I feel
the
this
way?
And I think that's a question we should always ask ourselves. But I get why he made this decision.
I understand the ambivalence. If a news organization has an actual document presented as research by a reputable political researcher to our intelligence agencies, who are we to keep the document from the public rather than publish it with the context included that these are unverified things that are claimed? And
BuzzFeed made that very, very clear.
They did.
And by the way,
I don't know that I would probably make a different decision for the show, and I wouldn't start talking about the unverified stuff. But in terms of just releasing the document to the public, I'm not sure that it was the wrong thing.
And by the way, I will join in, and I actually will just forthrightly defend BuzzFeed on this because we live in a world in which WikiLeaks dumped documents,
exactly.
And their entire philosophy has been, we don't edit or censor the document. We put the document out and let the public decide. No less a person than Donald Trump said, I love WikiLeaks. Put it out there. Let the public decide what's true and what's not. And by the way, Malcolm Nance and other security experts said to us, be very careful about the WikiLeaks documents, because since they came through Russian intelligence, things could be altered. They could alter some of those emails. The media did not make that sort of pretty distinction. They simply vacuumed in and then disgorged the WikiLeaks, used it in stories, used it in headlines, used it in scoops. Donald Trump loved WikiLeaks, loved the idea of using things like Pizzagate, completely unverified, ridiculous conspiracy theories, as long as they advance his career. It's quite ironic for the Trump people to take umbrage at the idea of what they did to Hillary Clinton to win suddenly being turned on.
I just want to underscore that, because this has been going through my head the last 24 hours, that I think everybody who's bashing WikiLeaks has to look at both their own behavior and what they said about WikiLeaks and all this other stuff. Is it somehow we really cannot hit a standard where it's okay to do it about politicians you don't like, then you celebrate it. But, gee, when it happens to a politician you do like, it becomes an outrage. There's something wrong with that.
It's always a good standard to apply to put the shoe on the other foot. Yep, what if this was somebody you supported, or if you support them, somebody you oppose? And with Joy Reid from MSNBC and E.J. Dionne from The Washington Post, Ryza in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ryza.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Yes, the reason I'm calling is because probably for the previous subject that you were talking about, Joy, and I identify with Joy and what she said about growing up growing up in Congo. And I have lived in the United States for 27 years. I'm an American citizen. But I also lived half of my life in Venezuela, where we went from a democracy, bad or wrong, but we still were a democracy to an autocratic government. And what I see in Trump is pretty much the hallmark of what we went through. I lived that, and yesterday it really, really sent chills upon my spine, and I'm really, really concerned. So I just wanted to share that I hope America can wake up and we can do all together something like President Obama said.
You know, it's interesting that the caller is from Venezuela. We have a part of South Florida is Western Florida that we call Westonzuela, because there's so many Venezuelans who exited Venezuela when Hugo Chavez came in. They couldn't. They were like, oh, we're done with this. Pulled their money out of the country and left. So there are a lot of people in our country, like your caller, who have lived firsthand under autocracy and can tell you it is so easy for a country to slip into authoritarianism. Not so easy to slip back out.
Isn't it interesting how easy it's been this hour to get callers? And I didn't ask for callers specifically to do this, but after you made that comment about what you knew from childhood or from your parents, that there was a caller from Morocco, boom, there's a caller from Venezuela, boom, saying, oh, I've seen this before.
Yeah. So, and unfortunately, there is that Godwin's law that you can't invoke the 30s and the Weimar Republic. But I think, and this is maybe a critique, EJ, for the left, so many people have been called Stalin and Hitler and was saying every Republican is the worst thing ever, that now when I also have Jewish friends that say, I don't know. Not that we're saying that Trump is to that extreme, but that the hallmarks of authoritarianism, Americans say that can never happen to us. There are plenty of people living alive today who can say, yes, it can.
Trump used Nazi.
Yes, I was just going to say that. And I
yesterday
was
against the CIA.
Right. And I try to be very careful about ever using a Nazi metaphor, because Hitler was a very specific kind of evil man who carried out massive genocide against the Jewish people and a lot of other people, and that you really need to reserve that metaphor for other things. So I'm horrified when people on my side use it. And I was also horrified that Donald Trump could take the fact, let's assume that the CIA did leak this, which they denied, by the way, even as they kind of confirmed that the CNN story was true. That's different. You cannot use the Nazi metaphor this loosely. And again, it goes to Trump's, shall we say, very loose use of language. It's really just, I was very chilled to see him do that too. But then I had a pretty negative reaction to that entire display.
By the way, we'll talk more about the CNN story with their media correspondent Brian Stelter, who's going to be one of our guests on tomorrow's show. Dana in Queens, you're on WNYC with Joy Reid and EJ Dion now. Hi, Dana.
Hi, hello. I'm a little amused by the reference all the time to the story, because you know you're all being distracted from the main event, and this is exactly what the Nazis did. There was a lot of show and tell before the Kristallnacht, and it was because they had a lot of distractions going on. Do you realize the Russians may have planted this distraction of this story about Trump cavorting, you know, unrealistically with prostitutes, maybe, at exactly the same time he was supposed to make his disclosure about divestiture? How does that happen?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was the Russians who planted it, but, you know, Joy, I heard on your network yesterday, I think it was Hugh Hewitt with Chris Matthews on Hardball, say, you know, as a member of the media, though a conservative talk show host, who wants to hold Trump accountable for these ethics questions, what a disservice BuzzFeed did by dropping this dossier on the public right at on the same day that Trump was going to hold this long-awaited news conference on ethics, because it did, as the caller says, distract the media and the conversation from what should have been the main story, which is Trump's evasion of reasonable ethics guidelines.
Well, I mean, that presumes that people in the media can't, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. I mean, people in my Twitter feed certainly managed to both laugh uproariously at the content in that BuzzFeed piece and continually harangue the media, why aren't you making Trump show his taxes? So if the average citizen on Twitter can hold both of those two ideas in their heads at the same time, the media is going to need to learn to stay on the main story. And there are two, I think. One is, and it's a legitimate question to ask, is this person who's going to be president of the United States compromised in any way by a foreign power? Because that actually matters for our foreign policy, for what kind of decisions he'd make, whether the decisions he'd make are driven by his own pecuniary financial interest or by some darker interest, meaning that there is something a foreign government has on him. That's a legitimate line of inquiry the media cannot drop. The second being his financial conflicts of interest, which feed into that same question. The idea of whether our president is vulgar has already been settled by his own words.
Could I just say, I think there are moments when Trump himself uses tweets to distract. And probably the classic case was when he settled the case against him involving Trump University, then tossed out that tweet attacking the cast of Hamilton for raising, in, I thought, a very polite way, but then I admit where I stand on all this, some sort of tough but polite words to Mike Pence when he went to see Hamilton. And that dominated the news, and the Trump University settlement didn't get much attention.
Yeah.
That's a case of that. I think in this case, you're talking about simply big news that is very important that broke. And I don't think we are going to lose track of Trump's conflicts of interest for an instant. The attack on what he did was immediate. The head of the Office of Government Ethics immediately said this is inadequate. I think we're not done with that story. He's not going to escape that story.
He does get the media to chase the rabbits, as some
he
people
does.
Call
he
it.
He does that sometimes. I don't think this is a case of that.
Tweets, because he didn't release this. Other people released mm-hmm. this. But he'll tweet something, and then everybody, Trump said this horrible thing, and it distracts people from what might be a more substantive and more damaging to Trump story. Trump, and I actually want to relate this to your book, because if FDR was such a successful communicator because he got the medium of radio, as you recount in introducing these Obama speeches, and JFK because he got the medium of television, maybe we can say the same about Trump getting Twitter. There's so much disparaging of him for using it, but I'll admit to not always agreeing with that, even if I don't like his content. Mm-hmm. If the president of the United States uses contemporary media tools to communicate with the American people, why is that good or bad in and of itself? Why is it so different from issuing, you know, little written press releases, which they do all the time, or something like that in old media?
And by the way, Barack Obama is president in part because he so mastered the modern mediums of communication, the internet, and et cetera. So, yeah, I think in and of itself, it's not a bad thing. I think it's that Trump is not using And he's quite good at Twitter. Having economy of language, not being a flowery speaker, being a very he speaks a lot like the average American speaks, so he's relatable. And so in that sense, he is good at Twitter because he doesn't have lengthy thoughts anyway, so he can truncate them into 140 characters. And he's willing to be mean and willing to be pejorative, which is part of also how you can win at Twitter. But the problem is when you're president of the United States, having the cleverness to use Twitter is one thing. Understanding the potential peril that you can create, meaning you can tank a stock by tweeting, meaning you can start a conflict around the world by tweeting. If he had the maturity to say, you know what, maybe, you know, I've written so many tweets that I have not sent, and I leave them in drafts. Mm-hmm. Because you have to think, well, what will be the consequence? This is so clever, and I feel so proud of myself for having written this. If I hit send, think about the consequences.
Count
a little
bit.
Yeah, I'm more careful on Twitter than a guy who's going to be president of the United States, because I really worry about what I'm going to say on this. Look, yeah, he's used Twitter in a very clever way. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But Twitter only takes you so far.
Right.
I still have respect for the long, considered argument that you make in a speech. And by the way, you talk about mastering the new media. Barack Obama realized that the long speech is actually more powerful now than it might have been 20 or 25 years ago, when the long speech at best would get a soundbite on the news. Yep. In the new era, millions of people downloaded some of Obama's speeches, like the Jeremiah Wright speech that we have in our book. So the long speech has actually been aided by technology. And I think we're going to see what Trump can do with the long speech in his inaugural address.
Yeah.
And historically, presidents have used the inaugural to try to pull the country together. Going back to Jefferson, we are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. Lincoln's second inaugural, one of the great speeches of all time, was about bringing the country together. Can Donald Trump do that? Does he want to do that? And we're going to learn that in a few days.
And I think I think EJ makes an important point, because the tweet can only get you so far. In a time of great national emergency, if there's another, God forbid, Oklahoma City, Clinton needed to rise to the occasion and speak to us. When the Challenger happened, and we were very, my mother's side, we took her side, we're very anti-Reagan. But when the Challenger happened, you know, I, as somebody who was not a fan of Reagan, can remember slip the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God. That's something that stays in your mind. Young people who were teenagers around Kennedy will always remember, ask not what your country can do for you. Mm-hmm. And my kids remember, yes, we can. That speech, even though they were kids, it became a YouTube hit single for Will I Am, where kids can say it was a dream that was written in the founding documents of a nation. You can actually quote these presidents because their words matter. If we have a time of grave crisis, Donald Trump is not going to be able to tweet. He's going to have to talk. And I am concerned that the crafter of his words right now, it's in the voice of Jefferson Sessions, because it's Jeff Sessions' speechwriters that wrote his convention speech. Are we essentially going to hear the voice of sort of throwback Southern conservatism as our national sort of voice of unity? I worry that that isn't going to work.
If I could jump in, we talked to somebody else about this, Joe and I, that one of the things we had to do when we put this book together is cut the number of eulogies because some of Obama's most powerful speeches were at times of death or in tribute. And if we had put, and some of them were great, and if we put them all in there, we would have consumed too much of the book, or it would have been too big. I think it's going to be a very interesting test of Donald Trump. And this has nothing to do with politics or our view of Trump. How is he going to deal with moments like that? Reagan was great at it. Clinton was great at it. Obama was great at it. Nothing so far we've seen tells us that Trump will be great at it. But will he rise to occasions like that?
We'll continue in a minute with E.J. Dionne from The Washington Post and Joy Reid from MSNBC. Their book, a collection of Obama speech texts, is called We Are the Change We Seek. More with Joy and E.J. in a minute. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Joyanne Reed from MSNBC and E.J. Dionne from The Washington Post, who have edited together a collection of Obama speech texts called We Are the Change We Seek. You could do the same thing we're doing with
Barack.
I was
thinking we could have
book.
A Barack super a Barack Bowl with taking all these speeches and sort of put them up against each other
That'd
and see
great.
What people think. I think I know who my winner would be.
Who do you think?
Selma.
Yeah, I agree.
I think his speech at Selma may be. I have one consensual one and one eccentric one, perhaps. The consensual one is Selma, which I think brought together all sorts of themes from Obama. And it was such a powerful moment going to the Edmund Pettus Bridge to celebrate that great victory. My more eccentric one is his 2006 speech on religion, his call to renewal speech that's in the book. And that's because I think it's one of the best speeches about religion that any politician has given. I have a lot of conservative friends who see it as a good speech as well, where he talked about the obligations of both secular liberals toward fellow citizens who are religious
yep.
and the obligations of religious people toward their fellow citizens who are secular or atheists or nonbelievers. And I would love him to go back and revisit those ideas after he's out of office.
You know, it's interesting. The speech that conservative friends of mine tend to like, and they were very surprised that they liked it, and I think it is one of my favorite speeches that he gave, was the Nobel speech.
Yes.
He was under tremendous pressure when he was given the Nobel Peace Prize, having just walked into office. And so the question of what do you do with that moment, you know, Dr. King got it after there was more of a body of work. But I thought the speech was brilliant in that it sort of wove through what people thought was his pacifism, which he's not a pacifist, and sort of the ideas of just war. And hearing that come from a progressive, I thought was a very interesting argument, a big case for America. I thought that was a good one. I agree, Selma to me is his greatest speech, but I always have had the most affection for the New Hampshire speech. The Yes We Can speech is still my favorite because I feel like it's the first time in a long time that a speech actually had pop culture resonance, and that ordinary young people, kids, knew a speech by a presidential candidate. I think that's so powerful, and it's something we need back because we are in an age of Twitter and 140 characters.
And maybe it's appropriate for the moment because it's worth remembering the Yes We Can speech was about a defeat, not
that's
a
right.
victory.
That's right.
And it was an interesting
turning. The New Hampshire primary
after
lost
he lost to
Clinton
Hillary Clinton.
In 2000.
And he turned an electoral defeat into a rhetorical
that's
victory,
right.
and that's a real trick.
And the speech he
Bill
gave
Clinton
the other night.
Did that a little bit in 92. But,
he did,
yeah.
absolutely, and he just did it again. I mean, he ended on that Yes We Can note, I think, precisely because Barack Obama really does seem to believe that defeat is temporary.
In the farewell address, you mean?
In the farewell address, and he came back to that theme because he was saying, wait a minute, don't look upon even this election as defeat, because defeat is temporary, justice is the long arc that we are eventually going to get to.
The one other clip that I pulled to play flows out of how you write in the book about how one of the burdens he faced was as the first black president being called upon in a different way than past presidents to interpret moments of racial crisis. So here's an example. This is a minute and a half of Obama reflecting on the outrage in the black community after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, who killed Trayvon Martin.
Now, this isn't to say that the African-American community is naive about the fact that African-American young men are disproportionately involved in the criminal justice system, that they're disproportionately both victims and perpetrators of violence. It's not to make excuses for that fact, although black folks do interpret the reasons for that in a historical context. They understand that some of the violence that takes place in poor black neighborhoods around the country is born out of a very violent past in this country, and that the poverty and dysfunction that we see in those communities can be traced to a very difficult history. And so the fact that sometimes that's unacknowledged adds to the frustration. And the fact that a lot of African-American boys are painted with a broad brush and the excuse is given, well, there are these statistics out there that show that African-American boys are more violent. Using that as an excuse to then see sons treated differently causes pain.
Obama, after the acquittal of George Zimmerman for killing Trayvon Martin, and EJ, with the cameras clicking there, it and the tone of his voice, it sounded more like a news conference or something that was impromptu than a speech with a teleprompter in, you know, the grand style. But you included that in the book.
Right. Well, there is a struggle in the country over race, and Barack Obama embodied it. He is, on the one hand, our first African-American president. He is also our first biracial president. And I think he felt a moral obligation to interpret both parts of the country to each other. You heard it in the Jeremiah Wright speech, where he talked about what is said in barbershops and beauty shops among African-Americans, and then what white people say about African-Americans when African-Americans aren't around. And there was a kind of candor there that Obama was sort of really uniquely able to channel, that he felt an obligation to channel. And, you know, his interpretive abilities could get him into trouble. You know, the famously for the quote, this is not in the book, when he talked about people who cling to their guns and religion. Now, if you go back and look at the whole context of that quote, it was actually very sympathetic to the white working class. But he was trying to explain why are they unhappy. But of course, that's not what came out. It was just that particular quote.
And it's interesting that, you know, this, as you said, with the cameras clacking because he didn't give a speech. You know, the race speech was the race speech, and then Barack Obama really didn't give a big, you know, talk on race, really probably until the Charleston massacre, until he really went, you know, right at it in a speech. And so I think one of the things from the African-American community's point of view was that what you just heard there was Barack Obama speaking after Barack Obama had become convinced that he was no longer able to persuade white America on the subject of race. You could hear it was almost sort of a defeated statement. It was a frustrated statement. And I can still literally put myself back in at that moment when Zimmerman was acquitted. And the air went out of Black America, of Black American mothers and fathers and children, of my children. And that was
really the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement.
No, Black Lives Matter, actually. Right. It wasn't that. It was when Trayvon Martin was killed.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. In 2012, when he was February 2012 was when hashtag Black Lives Matter actually was created. It was created about him, who was a sort of a wannabe cop. But when he was convicted, I mean, when he was acquitted, what it said to Black people, and I think Maxine Waters articulated this, it said, your lives mean nothing in this country. That was the clear message of that verdict. Your lives are throwaway. They're meaningless. And we can kill you, whether we are a police officer or just a guy. We can kill you at will, and no one will do a damn thing to us. So, sorry. Too bad. And when the president of the United States is Black people expected him to say a lot more than that. They expected him to get up and speak to our pain. And he had this inability to emote in those moments, which is ironic because he's so eloquent, but he didn't use it in that moment. I think he then wound up really making up for that when that Charleston massacre happened. And then with Selma, he really made up for it.
And he was very different giving a speech from a teleprompter than, you know, answering questions at a news conference or in an interview, where he could be so cerebral and hesitant sometimes, and maybe we heard it in that clip, that his supporters wanted to shake him and say, you know, get some passion, man. Did you experience him that way?
Well, you know, when you heard him give some answers, you could almost hear the gears of his brain working through a problem. We forget that Barack Obama was also a college professor.
That's right.
And this was an important part of him. And on the one hand, it's actually, I think, since I guess I'm a college professor too, an admirable part of him, because he really tries to see, well, here's how this fits with that, but this contradicts that. And he's trying to work all that through. Rhetorically, that's not always the most powerful thing, and that there are times when the moment demands something other than an analytical response. He often rose to that, but didn't do it every time. And that's, again, a thing we talked about a lot, that when you have a reputation as a great speech maker, when you give an okay, ordinary speech, it's seen as somehow a failure. And, you know, one of the things that is striking is he was never quite as successful on certain policies like Obamacare, like the stimulus, in using these gifts to defend particular policies as he was to defending large principles.
Yeah. We just have a minute or a minute and a half left. The book is a collection of speeches. The speeches are things that people heard if they heard them. And, you know, it was there was an emotional connection between mouth and ear and heart. What do you hope readers will take from owning this volume and reading these speeches as text on a page?
Well, I'll tell you, myself reading them as somebody who enjoyed the speeches and is a big fan of Barack Obama, the speechmaker, I find something new in them when I read the text, disembodied from his voice. You can see the subtleties. You can catch some of those turns of phrases you might have missed if you were making your coffee and watching the speech in, you know, in some primetime hour. And so I hope they take away from them an overall philosophy that Barack Obama had. These speeches sort of unify the man. They make you see who he is and really reconvince you, if you weren't already, of his deep love and belief in democracy, in American, in the uniqueness of American democracy. And he's unique in his ability to communicate it.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I think there are two things. One is you can actually relive those moments again if you saw the speeches when you read them. That happened to me. But we also have to remember Barack Obama is a writer. Mm-hmm. That's one of the ways in which he identifies himself. And some of these speeches are the speeches of a writer, so they actually read well within hard covers.
The collection of Obama speeches is called We Are the Change We Seek, the speeches of Barack Obama, edited by Joanne Reed from MSNBC. Her show AM Joy airs Saturdays and Sundays, 10 a.m. to noon. And Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne, thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A couple quick stories about the post-election new normal or new abnormal before we introduce our next guests. One is, I was listening to a sports talk show a few weeks ago, white male host with a white male caller. They talked about a few sports topics, but it was also the day after the actress Florence Henderson had died, which the caller respectfully noted with his affection for her as the mom on the Brady Bunch. And the host threw in, "Yeah, and she was a good-looking broad." Then he caught himself and said, "Oh, I guess I shouldn't use that word." And the caller replied, "Yeah, but it's the age of Trump now. It's okay." So that's one story. The other is just an email that I got because I'm all on all these political lists from the Republican strategist Roger Stone, big Trump supporter. It was right after President Obama expelled those Russian diplomats as retaliation for the election-related hacks. Subject line from Roger Stone, "Obama is a schoolgirl." And the email begins, "Patriots, I hope you had a Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah. Obama and the liberal left never ceases to amaze me how much they are disconnected from reality and act like schoolgirls. The Russian retaliation was nothing more than Obama embarrassing himself one more time before he leaves office." And the email goes on, but what struck me was the gendered message, "Obama is a schoolgirl." Cue the music. The band is the Ying Yang Twins. The song is called "Halftime, Stand Up and Get Crunk." And the genre is called crunk. And with me now are the three editors of a book called The Crunk Feminist Collection. Brittany Cooper, a co-founder of the Crunk Feminist Collective and professor of gender and Africana studies at Rutgers. Susanna Morris, another Crunk co-founder and African-American literature professor at Auburn. And Robin Boylorn, interpersonal and intercultural communication professor at the University of Alabama. They'll be doing an event at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture of the New York Public Library tomorrow night at 6:30, by the way. That's why they're all in New York from far-flung corners, at least in two of the three cases. And it's billed tomorrow night as where pop culture and politics intersect with race and gender. Professors, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll get to some of the essays in the book, but anyone want to react to either of those anecdotes as reflection of a new normal or new normalized post-election?
You know, this is why we need a revolution. There is this real serious attempt to make the kind of chicanery and ridiculousness of the Trump era reasonable and normal. And it's not this sort of hatred of women, the hatred of immigrants, the hatred of people of color. We have to stop that. We have to stop it now. And, you know, there's also just this delusional sense on the right that Obama is the one who made all of these errors, and there's this sort of backlash, or really, as some have called it, a white lash against Obama. And I think that it's really important for us to say that each and every time, that in many cases, many of Trump's supporters are really, spiting themselves, spiting their noses, right?
And that was Professor Cooper from Rutgers.
Yeah.
Professor Morris, of all the genres in music, why crunk feminist collective in particular?
Well, part of it is because of the time when we started the collective. It was in the early 2000s. Some would call that the height of crunk music. And so what we were doing was clapping back at or being confrontational or speaking truth to power in particular kinds of social moments, but also at the same time going to the club, dancing, being young people. And so we were like, you know, the phrase, oh, I'm getting crunk, or I'm feeling crunk, or I'm crunk, was going around, and we would use that to describe how we would, you know, clap back at somebody or say, you know, what Brittany just said about, you know, the right being delusional and normalizing violent rhetoric. Well, that's getting crunk verbally. It's a rhetorical tool, right? So we use the musical term to describe our political rhetoric. So.
And I see your mission statement locates crunk as a blend of hip-hop and Southern Black culture and references the South as a place where many of you do important intellectual and political work. Is it just because you happen to teach at Auburn and the University of Alabama, or is there a particular intellectual or activist Southern piece, Professor Boylorn, that would be different than a Northern one?
I think so. The South definitely has a particular aesthetic and mindset around things that are happening, and they're oftentimes misunderstood, misheard, or muted when it comes to those issues. So I think that it's an opportunity for us to bring a microphone to the South, to the ways that these things are functioning in the South and that how they impact people in the South.
So it's all about Alabama today. Senator Jeff Sessions and his confirmation hearing for Attorney General.
Yes.
The Crimson Tide football team losing the heartbreaker in the college football
champion. I'm not over that. Yes.
And now you're here. Do you think the struggle for race and gender equality is different in qualitative ways in Alabama than in New York or at Rutgers in 2017?
Now, I do think that there's a misconception that racism lives in the South. And let's be clear that racism lives everywhere. But there are ways that it functions in the South that is different and distinct. And so people of color in the South understand race in a particular way. And the way we interact with white folk in the South is inherent in that, like it's based on those experiences that we have, whereas there's this assumed progressivism of the North where, you know, there's an assumption that, well, we're not racist, but you really are. So I think that it manifests differently, but it exists everywhere.
Absolutely. Professor Cooper, you want to pick that up?
Yeah, let's remember that Trump is from Manhattan. I mean, or Queens, as some people say. He's a New Yorker, and he has some of the most vile race rhetoric that we've seen in a couple of generations. But also, so there's a way in which Northerners, I'm from Louisiana, so it's not just that we taught in the South, but we're all from the South as well, in some form or fashion. And, you know, there's a way in which Northerners are very polite about their racism, right? So it happens behind closed doors. In the South, people just put a Confederate flag on their truck and you sort of know where they stand. And frankly, you know, I like that, right? I don't like the Confederate flag, but I like that I know where you stand. And so that lets me know how I'm going to engage you.
Did you want to continue that point?
No, I think that that's true. As someone who's lived, I grew up in Connecticut. I've lived in the Caribbean. I've lived in South Florida. I've lived in Atlanta and Alabama. So I feel like I've run the gamut in many ways. And I completely agree. Growing up in small city, old Milltown, Connecticut, the KKK would march every year. You know, there were open displays of racism, even though I live in an integrated community and went to integrated schools. Right. So it's both. And there's no history of the United States without racism. You know,
212-433-WNYC for these three members of the Crunk Feminist Collective, editors of the Crunk Feminist Collection, which is the book. And Betty in Manhattan wants to chime in. Betty, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if the women feel that some of that comment that you played at the top of the program, does this kind of indicate that maybe some of the misogyny that is hidden will now be brought out, and we're actually going to see what so many men are actually thinking and feeling about women? Maybe that's something that we can combat in some way.
The equivalent of the Confederate flag on the trunk, maybe a truck, maybe, Professor Cooper.
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, we began to see it during the election season with the just sort of overt disdain for Hillary Clinton, you know, and look, it might not be the most radical feminist position, but I do think it's important to say that it is partly about misogyny and patriarchy, that the woman who won, you know, the popular vote by millions of votes is not the president of the country. And so that's also rooted in a deep sort of misogyny. And just like we saw with Barack Obama, where his race created all these kinds of problems for white folks that we're living through, the prospect of a woman running the empire has created this dystopia that we're now living in, where folks would rather have this very unqualified man in charge than have one of the most qualified candidates ever that we've seen in the in the 21st century and for the better part of the 20th century running the country. And that's a problem. And so it can be about many other things. It's a more complicated story than patriarchy and race and misogyny, but it is certainly a story of patriarchy and misogyny.
Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I was telling your screener in regards to how we think about women and language. There's a game that I'm an acting teacher, and there's a theater game I like to play with my students called In the Manner of the Word, where you have to ask the students to perform a task in the manner of the word, usually an adverb. And one word I always love to use is girlishly, because it really reveals what people, you know, sort of ingrained ideas about girls and women are. They'll often act very silly or skip around. Sometimes they act a little dumb. And then, you know, it always prompts a pretty interesting discussion about, you know, sort of the hidden, the ideas of misogyny that are so embedded in us.
So when I read that Roger Stone email subject line about Obama is a schoolgirl, that triggered that thought in you about
Absolutely.
How you teach?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Let's talk about some of the essays in the book. Professor Cooper, I see one of yours is called Jesus Wasn't a Slut Shamer, or How Conservative Theology Harms Black Women. Now, Jesus and slut shamer aren't words we often hear in the same sentence, even in the negative. So what's your premise?
That when we look at the story of the woman caught in adultery in the Bible, this is the story where Jesus says, you know, if any of you who is without sin, cast the first stone. That's also a story about a woman who had been caught in quote-unquote sexual sins in her culture. And Jesus didn't allow these men to actually shame this woman who was getting around and getting it in. Instead, he said, you know, you need to, you know, look at your own selves and look at your own behavior, in part because clearly she wasn't getting it in by herself. Right. And so that's also a model for us when we try to think about how we can blend faith and politics. And it's particularly important in this moment where we've seen the evangelical right line up behind Trump. And so one of the things that I do at the Collective specifically is say there is a progressive, radical, feminist version of being a person of faith. And this is one of the things that it can look like.
So, Professor Boylan, did you hear the news story in New York this week to that point about the Brooklyn Police Precinct Commander Peter Rose, who told the news site DNA Info the date rape was, quote, not an issue we're too worried about, because some of them were Tinder, some of them were hookup sites, some of them were actually coworker. It's not a trend that we're too worried about, because out of 13 sex attacks, only two were true stranger rapes, unquote. Now, he's apologized. But actually, I should go to you, Professor Cooper, because it relates to the idea of slut shaming.
Well, you know, it just makes me think about work that we've done at the Collective. You know, we have survivors of sexual violence as part of our community of readers and writers. And so I'm thinking specifically about the work that we all do in feminist classrooms. And Susanna can speak to some of this work around just, you know, combating sexual violence in particular ways.
Absolutely. Understanding, like, the definition of sexual assault, like even the term date rape is rather dated, right? I mean, pun intended. The whole notion of that you go on a date with someone versus stranger rape, right? Understanding that many sexual assaults, in fact, most sexual assaults happen with someone that you know, right? That intimate partner violence, sexual assault, physical assault, that these are things that are not like some boogeyman in a dark alley with a trench coat and nothing else on. You know, that's how we sort of imagine violence of all sorts, whether it's rape or child abuse or even racism. We imagine a kind of boogeyman somewhere, but it's actually much closer to home, and that's much more scary. And if we can own up to that, going back to the parable with Jesus, right? It's actually in our community. This woman cannot sin alone, right? So these sins of sexual violence are sins of our community that we actually can be accomplices to, right? By not actually using the right terminology, by not holding people accountable and so on. If our actual officials, our police officials who are supposed to keep us safe, don't have the right language, then we're doomed.
I think Thomas in Brooklyn wants to push back on the idea that it's good if our racism and sexism surface. Thomas, do I have that right?
Yes, I've heard that argument a number of times, and you know the first time I heard it, it made me think twice because I sort of agreed with it. But that's just I don't think that's the case. The more time that I've spent thinking about it, I think it's important to acknowledge that for generations we've fought to keep this from the surface of society, and we've fought to create this culture where people have to hide their Confederate flags, people have to hide these racist and misogynist tendencies. And I think that's actually the best tactic we can hope for and the best we can take. And I think we should be working to sort of push this from the front of society and push it down until we kill it, basically.
It's racism shaming compared to what we were talking about before as maybe a good thing. Professor Boylan, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking that the ways that racism hides and how sometimes that makes us feel better because it's not, you know, explicit. It's more covert. And in some ways, that's okay, you know, because I tell my students that, you know, it's 2016, now 17. It's not okay to wear your KKK T-shirt to class. But I still need to know if that's your mindset. I need to know how you're thinking about race politics. I need to know whether or not you have problematic, you know, ideas about race and ethnicity. And I can't know that if you're hiding it. I can't teach you to think differently if you're pretending to think differently than you actually do. So I think that you know, and it feels more dangerous. This feels like a more dangerous moment, this Trump moment, because racists feel emboldened to express that hate. Yeah. And I think that in the academy, at least, many times we get used to people hiding it. And that makes us feel more safe. So we know they're not quite right, but it's not in our face. So I think that there has to be a happy medium. While I'm not trying to have to encounter daily that daily assault of blatant racism on my way to work, when I get in my classroom, I need students who have been conditioned to hide it, to expose it a little bit so that I can combat it through education.
Let me ask you all about feminism and the election. Earlier in the show, we talked to Emily Bazelon from the New York Times Magazine, and she wrote an article on white college-educated women who voted for Trump, which was 45% of white college-educated women. And one who she wrote about from Pennsylvania named Palma Frabel, self-employed as a marketing consultant, has a degree in the equivalent of graphic design from the Art Institute of Philadelphia and another in small business administration. She has adult daughters, apparently. And this says, Frabel also admires Ivanka Trump and felt she was one of the campaign's top three assets. She sees Ivanka as a role model for Abigail, I think that's her daughter, in her own entrepreneurial interests. It's not Hillary's Gloria Steinem feminism, as Frabel put it, that she values. It's Ivanka's sleek version of female success, which commentators have labeled commodity feminism, branding to sell products. But she said, I've been paid the same as men. I've managed men. I've not had any trouble working with men. And Emily Bazelon concludes, for Trump supporters that I talk to, college education didn't seem to lead to support for the liberal women's movement. So, Professor Morris, maybe you want this. I'm just curious about your reaction to that. And since 45% of white college-educated women voted for Trump, the idea of college not translating for that many women into what that source called Hillary's Gloria Steinem feminism?
Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple of things happening here. One, I think there's a disconnect. I don't like to necessarily use the second wave, third wave rhetoric and so on, but I do think it might be helpful in this instance. So I think that there's sometimes a disconnect intergenerationally between folks of the second wave and folks of the third wave. This person sounds like she has adult children, but she could be a Gen Xer, you know. So I think some of the strides that were made in the 70s and so on, they seem distant. They seem far away. It seems like that's old hat and we don't have to struggle in that same way. I work with men. It's fine and so on. Right. I think the other point to be made here, too, is that this is why intersectionality matters. This is why looking at not just gender inequity, but racism and classism and so on and other systems of power are important, because for some white women, I think that 45% who voted for Trump, the one thing that they needed to make themselves fine was to get rid of patriarchy or sexism. Once they felt like it was over, then they're good, right? And the rest of us are like, well, I'm over here battling homophobia, transphobia, ableism, and so on. Like, I have a lot to be before I can even, like, get to the top, right? And if the one thing between you and making it is, you know, somebody with, you know, calling somebody a broad or something, and you're like, I can overlook that, you know? So I think that there's a way in which a narrow focus on sort of patriarchy and this, you know, very superficial elimination of it that has some people just willing to look at, oh, Ivanka's smart. She has a great bag and she's super rich.
Her bags are fly.
Her bags are amazing, but you can be fly and have good politics.
All right. We're out of time, except to say, Professor Borland, maybe you want to do this. What can people expect if they come see you at the Schomburg tomorrow night?
A crunk conversation.
Fair enough, which would only to be expected from the Crunk Feminist Collection. Our three guests, co-editors of the Crunk. Okay, I blew the whole thing.
It's a tongue twister, yes.
It's a Crunk Feminist Collective that will be appearing tomorrow. The book is the Crunk Feminist Collection. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.